My name is Scott Harris, one of the producers of the radio program called Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and a board member of the news and analysis website Toward Freedom. Toward Freedom, just to let you know about the group sponsoring the panel, Toward Freedom began as a print publication in 1952, where it carried unique reporting about the dynamic, progressive, and independence movements roiling through the developing world back then. We've had a real good tradition at Toward Freedom for many years of bringing new voices to journalism, people from the countries that they're reporting from, and Ben carries that on today with a whole host of new writers that he's featuring on the website. Between the Lines, we got our start back in 1991, covering the first Persian Gulf War. It kind of developed into a collective. We have an all-volunteer group that every week produces the radio show, goes out to about 50 stations, on a whole range of topics, presenting progressive voices, not heard very many other places. Both Toward Freedom and Between the Lines have sponsored a number of forums like this in Caracas, Venezuela, at the social forum, also in the first U.S. social forum in Atlanta, and we hope to do something in Detroit this June. So I hope you all know about the Detroit social forum coming up. I think there's some panels on that here. Just a quick intro before we get started with our panelists. But as the Cold War ended with the demise of the Soviet Union and movements to the left stagnated or faded in the rest of the world, Latin America became the setting for some of the most vibrant and successful progressive organizing seen in many decades, overcoming generations of U.S.-supported dictatorships, oligarchs, and Washington's long history of overt and covert intervention to suppress progressive labor and political organizing. New grassroots movements sprouted up and allied themselves with political parties, often to take power in successive governments across the hemisphere. And Washington-backed neoliberal policies, of course, are one major contributing factor as a catalyst for really moving the demand for change across Latin America. And you probably heard some of these statistics that from 1980 to 2000, the per capita GDP grew by only 9%, and from 2000 to 2005, it was at an incredibly low 4%. Of course, that was one of the driving factors for change. People's living standards were reduced, inequality was rising, and I think it's pretty clear right now here in the United States that we're now experiencing our own economic meltdown, certainly not to the extent Latin America did in many ways, but for some, it is true. The economic collapse really here in this country, pretty much the responsibility of some of the same financial institutions that wreaked havoc in Latin America, plundered that part of the world. And of course, the topic we're talking about today is lessons we can learn from the courageous people across Latin America that, you know, from all walks of life, factory workers, artists, community organizers, farmers, that have succeeded in so many ways of bringing the fight for equality and social justice to the halls of power and actually taking leadership and taking power in some of these countries and moving social policies in a progressive direction. And today's panel will be focusing on the lessons we can learn from our counterparts in Latin America and how their approach to organizing, political education, the use of community media, as well as strategies and tactics can improve our chances here in the United States to advance beyond where we seem to be now, which is organizing every 2 to 4 years for mediocre candidates and mediocre political parties, and there's no follow-through on actually holding them accountable once they get in office. Certainly Barack Obama is a case in point, and I know that's a topic of discussion across this conference this weekend. Our panelists today will be sharing what they experienced firsthand in places like Argentina, Bolivia, and Colombia. We're going to first hear from Marina Citrin, and just to give you a brief introduction, Marina is the editor of Horizontalism, Voices of Popular Power in Argentina, published both in Spanish and English. A new edition of the book will soon be published entitled Dreaming Without Limits, Horizontalism and Autonomy in Argentina. The book chronicles Argentina's new social movements, which sprang to life after the 2001 economic crisis there. And she offers a profile of the democratic ideals that have shaped these grassroots groups' actions in politics. Marina has a number of new projects underway, currently co-editing a book titled Insurgent Democracies, Latin America's New Powers, that will be published next year. While living in Cuba during 2009, she worked for Prensa Latina and began writing a book about Cuban life. Marina is an attorney, a PhD candidate in global sociology at Stony Brook University, and has published a number of articles for various magazines and journals. So please welcome Marina.
Great. Okay. Well, over the past 10 years, as just was introduced, we've seen an incredible rise of powerful social movements and left and progressive governments in Latin America. From the more radical of the Evo Morales and Chavez types to the more progressive with Cristina Kirchner and Lula. And clearly the rise of these governments comes from the power of the social movements. And while in some countries there are more changes being implemented from above, generally the changes that are taking place are due to the power of the social movements from below. What I'm going to focus on in this conversation, though, is, and hopefully we will have time to have a really nice conversation, is the more self-organized and autogestiva movements and communities, and specifically the more horizontal of these organized groups. I believe them to be both the most effective and effective. So effective with an E, meaning concretely achieving, you know, what they need as far as survival and sustenance, and effective with an A, in what they're creating with regard to new social relationships, new subjectivities, and what used to be called the creation of a new person. Che Guevara wrote a famous pamphlet called The Creation of the New Man in Cuba. And now people are talking about what they're creating right now and what they're being now, being new actors, being social protagonists in the now, in the day-to-day relationships. I could talk about El Alto, or the Regantes in Bolivia, that Ben, I think, is going to talk about some, or segments of the MST in Brazil, obviously the Zapatistas in Chiapas, or the communal councils of Venezuela. But due to time and diversity, I'm going to speak about Argentina. This is also the area where I've spent a lot of time over the last 10 years living there after the popular rebellion, and then going back most years and spending a bunch of time throughout, you know, over the course of all of these years, including just a few months ago. And also, for this topic of economic crisis, it's the country that's had the deepest economic crisis in the recent past, with the economy collapsing in 2001, the government defaulting on over $95 billion in debt, which is the greatest government default, and then the government freezing all bank accounts as a result. So Argentines faced a total collapse and had to figure things out pretty much for themselves. And it's from this experience and the organizing that resulted that we can learn some of the lessons for a situation that is fairly similar. Hopefully it won't get to that same level, but possibly will. But also to open our imaginations as to what's possible. So it's kind of walk with me and imagine a little bit as we go here. When I say diversity in Argentina, I say that based on the range of social classes and identities involved in the new social construction over the past 8 years. You have on the one hand the working class. So what Howard talked about in some of the visits he saw in Argentina and going to recuperated workplaces, where before 2001, there were one or two workplaces that workers were in the process of taking over. And now there are many hundreds of workplaces that workers take over and run directly without bosses, generally without forms of hierarchy, and often with what people refer to as horizontalidad, horizontalism. And these workplaces range from auto parts to ceramics to daily newspapers to medical clinics, a four-star hotel. It's a very wide range of workplaces. You also have the unemployed, who began organizing in the later 90s, making piquetes. So they're often called the piqueteros. And a piquete is a road blockade. So people who are without work really face no prospect of having work in the future. And their only tactic and the way to get leverage, since they don't have a workplace, they can't shut down the workplace for leverage, is blocking a road or blocking a bridge, a major artery, to then make demands. And in Argentina, it was through doing this that they won the first unemployment subsidies in Latin America. But in organizing in the late 90s, what they also did was to push out the punteros, which are like caciques in Mexico. They're these like political party brokers that facilitate between the group organizing and the government. So to push that and to do it again together without hierarchy with forms of horizontalism. And then there's the middle class and kind of the post-middle class. I think it's a whole issue that could be discussed is what is middle class? How do people identify? And while some people are still in some of the neighborhood assemblies, others have begun organizing in other areas, and many now refer to themselves as hijos of the 19th and 20th. So the popular rebellion was on the 19th and 20th of December, it's when it began. And people are calling themselves the children of that, assuming horizontalidad in a lot of the new relationships that they're creating in these groups. So going back to 2001, the economy collapses, but really collapses. It comes on the head of... Sure. This is a microphone, but it's recording, so it's not going to help me project. So I'll drink some water. Maybe that'll clear my throat. Okay, so we're back to 2001. After a process under Menem of growing privatization and privatization of everything. We're talking about the roads, the airlines, the subway, the zoo. I mean, privatizing every single thing they possibly could. The crisis comes to a head. The government fears a run on the banks, so what they do is freeze bank accounts. So imagining tomorrow you wake up and your bank card doesn't work and you go to take out money and you have no access to your savings. And that's part of what spurred people going out into the streets on the 19th of December with a cacerolazo, which is a banging of pots and pans. And people came out one after the other, hearing the sound of the pots and pans, and then hundreds of people and thousands and tens of thousands, in especially the urban areas, banging pots and pans. And what came out of it was not political parties or big placards or anything like that. It was just not even a chant. It's a song. It's que se vayan todos, que no quede ni uno solo, which is that they all must go and that not even one can remain. Just imagine hundreds of thousands of people pouring into the streets day after day, and the first government resigns, and then the second government resigns. And within a few weeks, four governments resign in Argentina. Okay. And then, so people are in the streets now, and they begin to look to one another. And in the more urban areas, they form assemblies that take the form of these neighborhood assemblies, people standing on street corners looking to one another to figure out, you know, now what do? How do we survive? And the unemployed areas, they'd already been organizing to some extent in the piquetes, making the road blockade, and then that developed their form of assembly in the unemployed workers' movements. And in the workplaces, hi, Ted. And in the workplaces, took the form of people taking over the workplaces, again, in assemblies, making decisions together, how to take them over, how they're going to run them in the future. And each place, though there's a very different history, it was the very same kind of rejection, the que se vayan todos, that they all go, political parties, bureaucrats, people with power over other people, getting rid of them. The idea was, as Pablo from a neighborhood assembly of Colegiales, which is in downtown Buenos Aires, said, simply we came together with a powerful rejection of all we knew, a strong rejection of political parties and the form of political parties, a strong rejection of all those that occupied spaces in the state or that organized to occupy positions in the state, with a rejection from the state and political parties to organizations who wanted to be a part of the state, and with a specific decision that we're going to do things for ourselves. The idea was not going to the institutions that created the problem in the first place, not to use the forms of organization that those who made the problems also use. So first people came together, not looking to the state, and they began looking to one another. And people refer to this as a rupture, using the actual same like word in Spanish, as ruptura, as a break, and a break with a past of fear. Argentina lived through a horrible military dictatorship with 30,000 people being disappeared, being murdered. And there was a common used expression, especially in the 80s, in the time of the dictatorship, was no te metas, like don't involve yourself with the other. And people would explain after the rebellion, we broke with that. It was a break with the no te metas and a coming together in this way that was horizontal. And person after person would also explain the horizontalidad. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from just coming together. And I would say, well, what does it mean? And people would go like this. I was also doing an oral history, so this doesn't work very well when you're recording. So, well, what is that? Well, it's not this. It's a relationship. It's not an idea. It's not an ideology. It's not some kind of ism. It's kind of like the anti-ism. So horizontalism is a tricky word in English because it's an anti-ism, but I translated it with the ism anyway because it's more than just being horizontal. It's a relationship. NECA from the Unemployed Workers Movement of Solano describes horizontalism, which I'm reading from the book, which is filled with testimonies of people from the movement. So if you want to hear their voices themselves, that's what this is full of. NECA says, we began learning together. It was a sort of waking up to a collective knowledge, and this had to do with a self-awareness of what was taking place in each of us. First, we began asking questions of ourselves and each other, and from there, we began to resolve things together. Every day, we kept discovering and constructing while we walk. It's like each day there's a horizon that opens before us, and this horizon doesn't have a recipe or a program. We began here, without what's in the past. What we had was our life each day, our difficulties, problems, and crises. And what we had in our hands at the time was what we used to go looking for solutions. The beginning of the practice of horizontalidad can be seen as a part of this process. It's the walk, the process of questioning as we walk, that enriched our growth. That helped us discover the strength. That strength is different when we are side by side, when there is no one telling you what you have to do, when we're the ones who decide who we are. I don't believe there's a definition of what we're doing. We know how it's done, but we're not going to come across any definitions. Similar to horizontalidad, more than a question, more than an answer to a practice, it is an everyday practice. This process and practice, and it's also that's also changing. And over the years, as people talk about it, they've been talking about horizontalidad more as a tool and a goal, that it's something you use to become more horizontal, but it's also you become more horizontal by using it. So it's this kind of dynamic. It's not by saying you're horizontal, therefore you are, but it's, again, the relationship and the process. And you see this in the various forms of organization and the different social relations, this kind of social relationship. Just to be clear, when I'm speaking about the movements, I'm speaking about the more autonomous of the social movements. So there are movements that have a relationship to the government. There are groups that want state power. But the most interesting, new, and I think effective are these more autonomous social movements with this idea of horizontalism and this concept of power. So the big question that comes up after this then is how to maintain the movements. In the first years, it was about meeting basic necessities. So people were taking over land, building homes on the land, creating food, creating gardens together, taking over factories to make them work and then to get a basic survival kind of wage. People were bartering, and actually what's recorded is the largest barter network in all of history. It was in Argentina in those first years. It went upward of 7 million people. And bartering not just things, but people were bartering services. So you had people bartering computer repair for French lessons or psychoanalysis for someone's child for empanadas. There was a very, very sophisticated barter network that the government came in and sabotaged. But that, again, is another discussion. But the challenges were the maintenance of the movements, especially in light of the state, which began to recover. And as it was recovering, it was trying to regain its legitimacy. And this is a population that's not even looking to the state. They're organizing with themselves and each other. In the first years, the state regains more and more legitimacy and tries to come in and take over the movements. But in this conversation, I think what's important is for us to imagine both what is possible, the new horizontal relationships and the creation of new social relationships, but also to look to some of the challenges. So what are some of the lessons for us so that we can imagine more what's possible in light of the different challenges? And the biggest challenges that I see are both the co-optation, the state trying to co-opt the social movements, and just direct repression by the state. Repression is kind of obvious as far as evictions, the killing of certain people in movements, especially young people more recently. But the co-optation is where it gets a little more tricky, and many people fell into that. Now, many of the groups who did become part of the government again were not of these more autonomous groups anyway. I think that is important. Some of, especially the unemployed movements that people have seen in the news, they're called like the Piqueteros K, like the unemployed movements that are for K, for Kirchner. But they were never trying to develop as autonomously. Their relationship was generally to the state. But it still has created a lot of disorganization for people in the movements. I know, I was just there very recently, and the movements continue to grow and deepen. And a question that I'm not going to really get into now, but I think it's really important to think about, is how people measure movements, and especially social scientists who've been going to Argentina over the past few years, saying, well, the movements are dead. They don't see the neighborhood assemblies, which is predominantly people who'd been in the middle class standing on the street corner, so they don't exist. Even though the recuperated workplaces are now many, many more, they're in the 300s, but that's not what's paid attention to as much, or the reorganization of the unemployed movements, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it's very sophisticated and interesting. But it's the question is how you measure success, I guess. This is one of the main questions that I've been thinking about. And do you measure success based on purely numbers or what you can see? You know, there are all of these different measurements in social science where is a movement successful, is it not successful? But this one woman in an unemployed movement was saying to me, well, we measure success based, you know, it depends. Is it from the perspective of dignity or of poverty? And if you measure success by dignity. And it's based then in these new affective relationships that are being developed, then we actually are more and more successful because they're creating themselves anew as new people and building these new relationships and deepening the horizontal relationships. So therefore, that is a measurement of success as they continue. Concretely, some of how the organizations are reorganizing, and I think it's very interesting in thinking about in the first years, many, especially in the unemployed movements, were saying we don't want to accept anything from the state. We're not going to accept unemployment subsidies. We're going to organize autonomously. And now it's a little bit more of a dynamic, thinking, well, what can we actually take from the state to support ourselves, but maintaining our own agenda? So, for example, the Unemployed Workers Movement of Solano is no longer called the Unemployed Workers Movement of Solano. It's part of a network that's almost like a kind of forming different collectives that then form almost like a federation and a confederation. There are more thousands of people in Solano now than there were before. And what they're organizing in each of these little groups is to have little micro kind of enterprises. So they might make sandals or food or build something. And they're getting primary resources from the state rather than money to then develop these things and then relate to one another. So they're getting the practice of doing it by themselves, making it by themselves in their neighborhoods, relating to one another in this horizontal way. And that also then, if the state says, well, we're not giving you cement or flour, there's the practice of having developed it and made it themselves rather than waiting to get the actually pre-made food or a home in some area that the state offers them. So this is the question of how to maintain... Wow, we're just getting more and more full. This is great.
Sorry.
No?
Go on in. There's another chair there, Scott. Why don't you unload your bag? Just in case...
So the biggest question now really is how the more autonomous movements can maintain their own agendas and continue with their own social relationships that they've been developing with autogestión, with horizontalidad, without the state interference and taking what they can from the state. So that there's a discussion with some women from a different unemployed movement that now is called the Movement for Social Dignity. And they say, the issue isn't just the physical confrontation with the system. Every day we're forced to confront a system that is completely repressive. The system tries to impose on us how and when we struggle. The question for us is how to think outside this framework, how to manage our own time and space. It's easier for them to overthrow us when we buy into concepts of power based on looking at the most powerful, based on something like weapons or the need to arm the people. We're going to build according to our own reality and not let them invade it. I think this idea of power as capability and a potential, not a control, is a very radical change from previous struggles. So power as a capability, as a potential, and not buying into these other concepts of power, creating it in your own time and space very concretely. And doing it in the now, this prefiguring in the day-to-day desires for the future. So the conversation is not about the world to win or making freedom someday, but it's about the creation of dignity and freedom now, today, prefiguring and manifesting in our relationships, those relationships that we desire, and using the tools of horizontalidad and autogestión so that we can do it in our own time and our own agendas. I'm going to read one last piece. It's my favorite chapter to this book and in the conversations I've been having with people over the years. And that I asked people what their dreams were, or dreams are. And person after person would explain that what they're doing is a part of their dream now, which is really profound. I mean, if you're asked about your dreams, it's not, oh, what I dream that someday I can be, or I hope to someday have. But people were saying, no, but right now, my life, this is it. And this one, someone just actually become a friend now from a movement in the south in Patagonia, in Ajin, which is near Neuquén, answered, so what are his dreams? And he says, I'll answer the question of my dreams with a line from the song by Los Redonditos. The future has arrived. The future is today. I believe we're living the future. That constant promise of capitalism was like a carrot held in front of the mule to keep it moving in the direction they want. What a lie. What sons of bitches. What a piece of absurdity they put in our drinks to choke us. The future is something to only hope for, and that's what will fulfill our dreams. No. Like Los Redonditos, I believe the future has arrived, that the future is today. Happiness isn't something you can postpone until tomorrow. We must live with total fervor today. If we postpone our dreams or put off our aspirations, we're delegating and we're subordinating. Subordinating the evolution of things we are going to do, or allowing someone to finish the things we aspire to. In the end, I believe every day must be lived. I believe that the rupture from the past is something permanent and something that is a part of our daily life. Freedom and the rupture are today.
That was Marina Citrin. For those of you who've just arrived a little late, and I know there's a lot of problems down at the registration desk, so we're recording this, so if there's a real demand for, you know, hearing what you missed, we'll make that available. See me at the end of the workshop. The title of our workshop is Lessons for Latin American Social Movements for a U.S. in Crisis, and we're going to be hearing now from Mario Murillo as well as Ben Dongle, and make time for some conversation as well. In introducing Mario, Mario is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Radio, Television, and Film at Hofstra University. He's worked in commercial, public, community, and college radio for over 25 years, most recently as a host and producer of Wake Up Call, that many of you've heard. I know the fan club's here, right? We found him out at WBAI in New York. And an award-winning feature producer. He's also reports regularly for National Public Radio's Latino USA, serves as guest host on WNYC New York Public Radio's The Brian Lehr Show, and writes a regular column for El Diario La Prensa, New York's largest Spanish-language daily newspaper. He's author of two books, Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization, and Islands of Resistance, Puerto Rico, Vieques, and U.S. Policy. In 2008 through 2009, Mario spent 6 months in Colombia as a Fulbright scholar, studying the strategic uses of communication of Colombia's indigenous movements, and is now finishing a book about that topic. Please welcome Mario Murillo.
Thank you, Scott, and thanks, Ben, Ben and Scott for putting this together. I'm actually surprised a big group that came for this. I'm pleased that we're all engaged in these issues, but I do feel uncomfortable talking about them, especially within the frame of the title of the panel, "Lessons from Latin American Social Movements for a U.S. in Crisis." I mean, you know, lessons is a big, tough word that I'm not comfortable using, especially given the different contexts that even, you know, Argentina, even within Argentina, the contexts are complex, and within Bolivia and Colombia. And so every country here in the U.S. obviously has its own lessons to share and to learn. So it's always, I always feel uncomfortable with that. But one of the good things about the title and the way we're framing this discussion is that it seems like it's turning the idea of solidarity on its head. For so many years, you know, it's been like, okay, what kind of solidarity can project from the north to the south to work with the folks who are struggling against U.S. imperialism, etc.? And now we're finally beginning to see it. No, we're the ones who need the help. We're the ones who need the guidance and the leadership from movements that are actually making some progress and really confronting head-on some of these very nefarious policies that are impacting people in so many ways. And so I recall when I was in Colombia during the Minga about a year and a half ago, the Minga, which I'll talk about in a second, it was interesting when we linked up with WBAI with one of the folks who was organizing the Minga, and then they asked the host on WBAI asked one of the leaders, so one of the organizers of the Minga, so what could we do up here to show support? And he goes, well, you guys should organize your own goddamn mingas. You know, you should be doing your own mingas. We got it. We could definitely use the visibilization or visibilizar. How do you say the conscientization up north about what's happening here? But you guys need to organize some mingas as well. So again, it turns the idea of solidarity on its head, which is I guess a good thing. In the next sessions, I'll be talking more. There's another panel that my friend Bill Weinberg organized around indigenous issues, and I agree with you about the point that there's very limited space here to discuss the struggles of indigenous communities north and south and globally in this left forum. But we will be talking more about indigenous movements in the Andean region in the next session, so some of you can join us there. And there I plan to talk more about the historical context of the indigenous movement, which is obviously very complex and not something we can talk about here in 15 minutes. So what I'm really just going to quickly go through and again, hopefully open it up for discussion, is the focus on the indigenous movement's Minga in 2008, which in many respects continues today. And I think some of you may have caught information about it. It was successful to the extent internationally that a lot of people started using the term Minga post the Minga in Colombia as a way of saying, yeah, let's organize, let's mobilize, let's bring people together. So I was going to talk a little bit about that. And I think the reason why it's so... there's so many similarities, for example, in terms of the horizontalism that Marina talks about, and you see in other struggles similar, you know, philosophies about, you know, the broad-based organizing as opposed to the top-down organizing. But in Colombia, it's very particular, particularly because of the acute nature of the internal conflict, because of the violence, because of the repression, the direct repression that continues to go on against the popular movement in a violent, neo-fascist form that Argentina had for decades, but that has kind of dissipated, doesn't exist in the same way. And so to understand the Minga, you have to understand the levels of repression that continue to exist in Colombia, and that the folks that are involved in this are confronting head on, very often costing their lives, which again is part of the history of Argentina and in Bolivia and throughout the region, but that it continues in a vicious fashion, notwithstanding the rhetoric and the public relations successes of the current administration that has been supported and embraced so much by both the Bush and now the Obama administrations. I'm talking about President Uribe, which we can talk about in a second. Just quickly, again, we can spend hours talking about all of these issues, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. I think the way to understand it, and I think it bounces off of your discussion about horizontalism, is that the indigenous movement in Colombia has always been, from the 70s, has always been organized on a horizontal plane, right? And particularly in the region where I've been working closely with in Cauca, in northern Cauca, where the movement emerged in the early 1970s, they looked at themselves as a comprehensive, they call it a plan integral de vida, plan de vida, a life plan that sprung from grassroots communication, organizing, on so many different planes. So you're talking about organizing around health and environmental issues, about economic development issues, about human rights and defense of territory issues. Communication has always been kind of the underlying kind of thread that brings them all together. And so, I've been working a lot on the community media and the video and the radio projects that these organizations have. But for them, those are just tools that are kind of expanding their grassroots communication processes that have existed for decades, right? There's a lot of scholars who have written about community media and citizens media, a lot of them good friends of mine, who've written about the empowering nature of community media, right? That when a community media radio station opens up in a local community, that it creates this space of civic engagement, that it gives people an awareness of their community's needs, and it gets them active and involved and mobilized and aware culturally, politically, socially. And I argue in the book that I'm working on and some of the things that I've written about this is that in the indigenous communities in Colombia, and particularly in Cauca, it's the reverse. The community media could not even exist, and the communities are already, from a very early age, already organized and mobilized and conscientious of the struggles of the communities. So you go to these assemblies, and it's very similar to what you described in Argentina. You go to these assemblies that could be small groups of 10 people to massive groups of 10,000 people, and you see the entire community engaging and listening and discussing all these issues of the plan de vida, the plan integral de vida. And what you see is that the media projects that are part of that are kind of accompanying it. It's not as if the media projects are suddenly brought in and the people are now suddenly aware, right? And that's one of the successes. That's one of the successes, I think, that we can talk about the in terms of the community media and the communications efforts that exist there. And it's something that we here could certainly learn by. Right, because on the one hand, look at even here the Left Forum, and this is not a shot at any stretch of the amount. I've been coming to Left Forum for years. I think it's a great space for everybody. meeting people from around the country, doing similar work, engaged in all these issues. But when you look at it, in essence, we're all talking to ourselves in many respects. We have 150 panels, and we're all, you know, talking about our own particular issues, right? And it's there's not an integral, you know, connection. And then so then you'll have the community media work. I mean, again, salute the work that you're doing with Between the Lines, and I'm sure there'll be BAI wackos floating around with their microphones and tape recorders, taping stuff for broadcasts over the next few days. All of that is good, but it's not linked organically to some kind of movement, some kind of struggle, right? I think the closest representation that we have in which, because what the way the media and during the Minga, during the Minga in 2008, the organizations were meeting for months with communities all over the country, but in Northern Cauca, they were going to the, they were working with the cane cutters who were on strike. They were working with the, you know, peasant farmers in Southern Colombia that were being displaced from their lands. They were meeting with the union trade unionists, and they were having these what they would call barridos, which were basically sessions like this where they would meet with the community and talk and challenge and debate the issues and start talking and saying, okay, this is why we need to do a Minga. The Minga basically is a collective horizontal effort in which everybody in the community or everybody in the organization, if you will, agrees to carry out an effort that's going to lead to some kind of positive change. So a Minga could be, you could do a Minga for the harvest, right? In which everybody in the community gets together and mobilizes around, you know, cultivating and doing the harvest. You could do a Minga to build a school in the community. You could do a Minga if somebody's kid is lost somewhere and they start looking for him. A Minga to challenge to look for somebody who was kidnapped, right, by the guerrillas or by other organizations within their territory. You'll get everybody together. So the idea was that they needed to, the idea of the indigenous movement was that we have to do a Minga not for indigenous rights. We have to do a Minga to transform, to try to begin to transform Colombian society. We cannot do it on our own. We cannot do it by ourselves. So the idea in 2008 was, let's carry out these barridos in community, from community to community to community, and begin to build this national movement that's not only indigenous, but that includes all these other sectors. The mainstream media in Colombia obviously projected it through the voices of the official sources, the leaders, the president, the security officials, the military folks. All of them were getting their voice heard through the mass media as if this was an indigenous protest, as if esos indios locos están movilizando otra vez. These crazy Indians are once again blocking the Pan American Highway, once again, you know, carrying out these acts of terrorism, and they were linked to the guerrillas on many occasions, leading to a lot of negative repercussions against the communities, and it was projected that way. So the indigenous communities had the challenge to confront that pervasive message that's constantly being delivered, right? And I think, I mean, if there's any parallel to that, I guess we can say maybe the Tea Party movement and its representation of the death panels would be kind of a propaganda equivalent in our context, you know, obviously for many different reasons. But the way the community mobilized and responded to it was to continue meeting and sitting and talking to the different communities, and they were reaching out to students on the university campuses. They were reaching out to trade unions. A lot of people with skepticism about the indigenous movement because they say, okay, these are indigenous communities that all they care about is recuperating their land and protecting their rights, and they don't care about me as an Afro-Colombian, or me as a trade unionist, or me as a woman, a day laborer or whatever. Why should I listen to you? So their approach was, no, these guys are, the media are distorting our message. We're trying to construct a grassroots mass mobilization. And I think that was the success in many respects of the Minga during 2008, because as it built, as every community, as they started marching from the south, and they started marching also from points north, but mostly from the south, they were meeting with all these different communities all across the country. They were breaking the myth of what was being put out in the mainstream media. And, you know, I'm not sure if, you know, again, using the perhaps displaced metaphor of the Tea Party and the death panels, but look at the mealy-mouthed, weak response to all those all those charges and all those claims that, that came here. I mean, perhaps we could learn something in terms of really resisting and really building a movement from that, from, you know, from, it's perhaps it's idealistic and it'll never never happen in the context of the United States, but it was something that was visibly successful in Colombia, especially when you started seeing them get closer to Bogota. You started seeing the communities, and they finally got to the capital, and they were being welcomed on the streets of Bogota by folks in business suits, you know, and the teachers' unions and students, you know, carrying placards, "Viva la Minga," whereas 6 weeks, 7 weeks earlier when it started, it was already, you know, written off as this kind of terrorist-linked indigenous mobilization that was spearheaded by and manipulated by FARC, and that these guys had no real agenda, and they were trying to write it off. And you know, obviously there are a lot of factors to that. I think they were able to generate a lot of international solidarity through the internet and through their their new media technologies. But I think without the traditional structures and ideas of how to bring people together, that wouldn't have mattered. I think ultimately it did have resonance nationally because of their capacity to organize and carry out these massive meetings all around the country. The problem is, and this is where, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about it in the next panel, because it's relevant to some of the things that you were talking about in terms of how you measure success. We're a year and a half past the Minga. We're now in an electoral season in Colombia. Just recently they had the primaries, and soon they'll have the presidential elections. And unfortunately, the indigenous movement is not a homogenous movement. I mean, that's probably a good thing. I don't mean that in a negative thing, but some of them do, some sectors of the indigenous movement do measure success in terms of electoral progress, in terms of how close they could be in terms of connection to and relationship with the state, right? Whereas the Minga's essence was to, mobilize regardless of the state and try to begin this process of national consciousness building. There's a very important sector of the indigenous movement that is still, you know, looking for their Senate seat or their congressional representation, or their, which they have succeeded. I mean, that's something from the 1990s in which they were successful in achieving. But 20 years after that, now things are different, and the crisis has evolved in Colombia to the point where now the indigenous movement is back to square one in terms of the threats to its plan de vida, in terms of the threats to its ability to confront these dangerous policies. And part of it has to do with the propaganda from the state. Part of it has to do with the influences of outside forces within indigenous territories, whether it's evangelical Christians who are going into these communities and telling the grassroots that they can do much better by leaving the cabildo, the town council, the community council, and joining a church. Or these aid organizations, including USAID, for example, who come in and help with development projects, local development projects, and communities that many of which are very, distressed, embrace that, and they see that the Cabildo, for example, is not doing anything. So some of them are real challenges. And then, of course, there's the constant threat that comes in the form of violence and intimidation and displacement and direct aggression to the communities. So I would argue, and this is something I'm trying to elaborate as I finish my manuscript, or the revision of the manuscript, I should have probably finished this a long time ago, is that the indigenous movement right now is facing the same threats of extinction that it was in 1970, 71, when they started their mobilizations and began their process of recuperation. And without the support of other sectors, without the support of the trade union movement, or collaboration with the trade union movement, or with the student movement, or with the Afro-Colombian movement, or the peasant movement, they're not going to succeed. And that's why the Minga is not an indigenous mobilization, and it shouldn't be perceived as that. It is more of a national mobilization of popular resistance to the neoliberal model that I'm sure we'll discuss more. Neoliberal model and interventionist militarist model that is exported, of course, from the United States. So I'll just leave it at that.
Our next and final speaker before we get to more of a conversation is Ben Dongle. Ben has spent much of the last 8 years as an independent journalist in Latin America, writing for such publications as The Guardian Unlimited, The Nation magazine, The Progressive, and Z magazine. He's received two Project Censored awards for his investigative reporting recently. And Ben is the author of the book The Price of Fire, Resource Wars and Social Movements in Bolivia. And he'll soon publish a new book, Dancing with Dynamite, Social Movements and States in Latin America, which is due out in July from AK Press. Ben is the editor of towardfreedom.com, a progressive perspective on world events, which is a co-sponsor of today's panel, and also the website upsidedownworld.org that I know many of you read. He's currently an instructor of Latin American history and globalization at Burlington College in Vermont. Please welcome Ben Dongle.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm glad you got through the doors. That was a really long line. I'm going to move up a little. My chair is a little too comfortable. It keeps on leaning back. So. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to kind of add on a little bit to what Marina and Mario have just said and talk specifically about some examples in Bolivia of the relationship between political parties, the state, and social movements, as well as draw some connections between actually drawing something from the experiences of Latin American social movements and applying them in the U.S. There have been a few examples of that happening. I won't exaggerate their importance, but just to make some connections and examples to show how space is being expanded. As Mario mentioned, this idea of learning from Latin American movements, lessons from them, reverses this idea of solidarity. Not just solidarity, but also the general direction of what has defined Latin American and U.S. Relations for decades, with the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the WTO, U.S. diplomats, CEOs, etc., coming from the North America to South America to establish structural adjustment policies, reorganize governments, privatize water, and so on. So this idea of bringing neoliberal expertise to loot a country coming from the south, from the north to the south, the idea of shifting it from learning from revolutionary movements, grassroots movements from the south to the north, is this idea of not taking, applying specific strategies from South America and applying them in New York or wherever, like the IMF might say, let's just take this structural adjustment policy and apply it wherever you are without considering the local ideas. What I think is interesting is to consider these social movements, these situations in different countries, to see what can be learned, and to look at these social movements and these relations between the state and social movements in a way that takes into consideration what we can learn, not just saying this is going on there. Wow, Bolivia just kicked out, you know, three presidents in 3 years. Not just seeing how they did it, but what could be learned from those situations to apply to localized situations here in the U.S. for those of us living in the U.S. So and there's many hopeful examples of things like what Marina and Mario have spoken of: alternative media, indigenous movements, the picateros, neighborhood councils, the landless movement in Brazil. And I think by studying those movements, with the ideas of learning what can be applied here, and not also just the solidarity from like the south to the north, but some kind of mutual solidarity in the spirit of the World Social Forums, for example, people learning from each other to identify common enemies, for example, the same multinational water companies might be trying to privatize the water in your hometown, and they've also done it in El Alto, Bolivia, and Buenos Aires. How do they work against it? Those kind of connections have been made in the U.S. and South America. Similarly, how can we identify similar enemies in the hierarchy of the state, political party, the dangers of working with the political party, the opportunities? The challenges that face people across the world are the same. How can we learn from each other to develop strategies that work? A lot of movements in Latin America have had victories. There have been comparatively fewer victories in the U.S. How can we make that, you know, make that imbalance disappear? So I think learning from each other in this kind of mutual aid across borders would be very helpful. So considering that and looking at Bolivia is a country where movements have been incredibly successful, incredibly mobilized, politicized, and there's this interesting dynamic where you have a political party that's defined itself as a political party of social movements coming to power, with Evo Morales as the president. So I'd like to look at Bolivia in this idea of what could be learned or garnered or just kind of considered in this situation, particularly in the challenges and opportunities and contradictions inherent in a political party that defined itself as a political party of social movements. So briefly go over some necessary context for Bolivia. Evo Morales came to office in 2005. He was elected in 2005. He came to office in 2006. Before his election, you have, let's say, three major mobilizations and uprisings that were completely transformative for the country. In 2000, in Cochabamba, there's a water war where citizens from diverse sectors, farmers, middle-class people, students, united for the first time in many years against this common problem of water privatization. They put the water back into public hands. There's been problems with the public management, but it became a symbol for the resistance against corporate globalization. And that example, that victory, ushered in a way a kind of new era in Bolivian social movements. And that that was significant in paving the way to the election of Evo Morales. 2003, you have the gas war. Which is a movement against a plan to export Bolivian gas to the U.S. for a very low price, and people were coalescing around this demand to nationalize the gas, to transform the government so it's not just representative of the oligarchy. They kicked out the president, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, to that October of 2003, and it was a national movement with basically every left indigenous workers organization mobilizing with incredible unity and tactics across economic lines and so on, ushered in a new era in Bolivian politics, made old political parties basically disappear from the political scene. Evo Morales, a president, a politician, a COCA union organizer, grassroots leader, working within the political party, the Movement Towards Socialism, runs on a ticket in 2005 to nationalize the gas, rewrite the country's constitution, grant more rights to indigenous people, redistribute land, and so on. So he's kind of riding this wave of discontent, this momentum, and he's elected in 2005. So considering those social movements that led to his time in office, the political party, the MAS, was very good at harnessing this energy. They represented popular sectors. They used the coca leaf as a symbol of an anti-imperialism, something that united miners who chewed it to work in the mines, farmers who chewed it. So this was the symbol of indigenous culture, anti-imperialism, the huifala, the indigenous flag of the that used in Bolivia to represent diverse indigenous groups, was used as kind of the political party's flag. I mean, they had a flag, but they also used the huifala. So this kind of unified groups across the sector, they're very good at this, and they won in 2005. The MAS won the presidency in 2005, the huge landslide victory. And so what happens? You have this era where movements are, self-managed in the case of El Alto and with neighborhood councils, looking to turn neoliberalism upside down in Cochabamba as far as the water issues go. You have the cocaleros in the Chapare developing their own governance from the 80s into the 90s, where there was a void of the state in these rural areas. So all this momentum is all of a sudden channeled into the MAS in a way, because they're saying the MAS is the hope for real transformation from the state, and these movements start mobilizing, not necessarily for anti-state ends or something that might correspond directly to their local needs without looking to political parties, but they're saying the MAS is the route to change. We need to defend the MAS against the right. We need to work to have a constitutional, rewrite the country's constitution, redistribute land, and so on. So you have this transformation going on in the ways in which people see social change, the roots for social change in Bolivia. Not that people weren't looking to the state and political parties before, but there's this redirection of momentum. So what are some of the the positive gains and challenges of this new balance of power. As I mentioned before, the MAS defines itself as a party of social movements. With this in mind, Evo Morales announces the partial nationalization of the gas in May of 2006. His party convenes an assembly to rewrite the country's constitution in August of 2006. They're moving ahead, at least in the rhetoric and the paperwork and partially nationalize the gas. They say they're going to redistribute the land, so they're moving ahead on a certain level. And what you see is this kind of shift from movements being the protagonists, the direct protagonists of change, to movements that are working within the party machine. And not to say that there aren't undeniably positive things that have happened under the MAS. Redistributing land to landless farmers, the billions of new dollars coming from this partially nationalized gas industry, the new rights granted to indigenous people through the Constitution, these structural changes that are undeniably good for the impoverished majority of the country. However, it is short of what many movements were calling for before Morales was elected. And rather than critique the party from within about these partial victories, they would movements and different organizations and leaders that I've spoken with over these years said there's this kind of self-censorship, this criticism to say, well, if we criticize the party from the inside, we're allied with the right, or they'll be labeled as allies of the right. And the polarization in Bolivia is so strong, the right is so powerful, and so much of a danger that they would actually win power. People say, okay, I want to support the MAS because otherwise the right will win this political battle, that political battle. They'll win implementing or blocking this law and so on. So this is one of the setbacks of major transformative experience, I think, and has been, this is what different movement leaders and union leaders have explained to me. So on the one hand, the Constitution was rewritten, but it only involved members of political parties. So you don't have direct representation from social movements, citizens groups. In order to become a part of the assembly to rewrite the country's constitution, you had to be a member of a political party. So what happened throughout the year that they were rewriting the constitution, it was totally defined by fights between political parties that had been going on for 50 years. Not to say that there weren't good things in the constitution, but this excluded certain sectors from having a direct voice and kind of watered down the debate with these party politics. There's also, so in El Alto, there are these neighborhood councils that were pivotal in the victory in the gas war in 2003. Neighborhood councils similar to the assemblies in Argentina, and groups that get together to kind of self-manage their own neighborhood, demand things from the local government, and so on. These groups are less mobilized today than they were in 2003, and many of the leaders within these neighborhood councils say that is because of a number of things that have happened with the MAS party. When the MAS came into power, leaders of these neighborhood councils, people that were active in it, were becoming distanced from their base. They were developing a distance from their base and attending MAS meetings, going to the government, trying to look for government positions, trying to get funding, trying to get better jobs, rather than being in direct contact with their bases, with their meetings, with these local meetings. Instead, they were spending time on campaigns, the various referendums that the MAS has organized. So there's this disconnect between the leadership in El Alto and the reality in El Alto. So what you have is this demobilization, and it's a kind of co-optation of the MAS, because they require this social movement energy to persist, to survive. And so much of it is defined by this kind of saying, okay, well, Evo Morales is, this part of the Constitution, I don't accept this part of the Constitution, but if we give any more ground, the right will have won. I don't accept this partial nationalization of the gas. I want a complete nationalization of the gas, but it's better than the right. So there's this similarity in the discourse, which is present in every country. I mean, we've all talked with people with the Obama administration, or as far as the Obama administration, okay, well, I want to support Obama. I want to support this bill because the right is worse. I mean, it's a problem that confronts everyone in every country. and in Bolivia too, which is often held up as this example of, you know, leftist victories and grassroots democracy, and it is. But assessing the positive things and the negative things is how we can learn from them, right? So we have the situation in Bolivia, and so I think making these kind of connections between the dilemmas that have arisen in Bolivia, a country with some of the most powerful social movements in the region, I'd say, that they confront these problems, how they work with them, and so how do the people work? How should we all work with that dilemma? I mean, how have they worked with it? So I think there's a few things that can be helpful in working with, you know, a political party in this context. One of them is knowing the stakes, understanding the game, understanding the dangers of co-optation, and understanding the territories of a movement's own autonomy compared to the political party. How to not get sucked into that and be co-opted and undermine your own local needs or more radical needs to the goals of the party. Because the political party, they want to meet the needs of the people, but they also want to persist in power. They also want to get more votes. They also want to get ready for the next election. So those things might undermine the needs of a movement. And it's happening in Bolivia. So knowing the differences of the space and defending one's own autonomy, or just not engaging with the political party or the state to begin with, which isn't the case with too many movements in Bolivia, but that's also obviously another route. And I think that in knowing that, you can kind of see the political party, see the state as a tool rather than be used as a tool for the movement, for the political party in the state, which I think is the balance, the dance that's going on right now in Bolivia that, you know, people could study and learn from. So that, what are we doing with time? Is that cover? Okay. So taking into account this idea of looking to South America and movements, wonderful grassroots victories, undeniable benefits of the government, like the MAS government in Bolivia, just making some specific examples of groups, movements, activists in the U.S. that have taken strategies in Latin America and applied them in the U.S. Not directly, but and not necessarily saying, okay, well, the people in Cochabamba revolted against Bechtel in 2000. I'm going to do that in my hometown. But seeing the similarities in how strategies can be useful across borders. So this has happened. And I'll give the one case of, so let's start with Cochabamba. After 2000, the water war in Cochabamba became a symbol for the fight against corporate control of water. And following that and leading up to it, there were a few examples of movements of citizens in the U.S. fighting against water privatization. And in interviews and accounts from these activists that have fought against privatization, they've said that they've not only learned from Cochabamba but seen experience, have been inspired by the strategies in Cochabamba and have learned from them. And so in 1998, Atlanta signed a deal with a subsidiary of French Suez, the company Suez, privatized water in El Alto, privatized water in Buenos Aires. There were movements against it, and there were movements against it in Atlanta, because of the corruption, the high water rates, the poor management of the water, but particularly the high rates. In 2003, after protests and complaints among citizens about the poor services and that the Suez subsidiary was providing, the city terminated the agreement. Only after persistent protests, campaigning, lobbying. Stockton, California, people fought against the privatization of their water system. It was going to be the biggest privatization west of the Mississippi, but people organized against it, concerned about the lack of transparency and the kind of track record of privatization, not only from the awareness that arose from the water war in Cochabamba, but you know, taking some of those strategies and pressuring their city council, they were victorious also in rejecting this privatization and putting the water, keeping the water under public control. Highland Park near Detroit also fought against high rates and privatization and were successful in 2007 thanks to their pressure on the city council. So there's these connections that are, you know, there between the North and South. The Chicago Republic Windows and Doors occupation, the sit-in in December of 2008 in Chicago. I don't want to exaggerate the importance of these examples, but there are some connections that are interesting. And so 200 workers sat in the factory in the Republican Windows and Doors. They were demanding their severance and vacation pay. Some of them said they sought to reopen the factory in ways to allow it to be self-managed and run as a cooperative. They've since been bought up by Sirius Windows and are still operating. But they said they took some of the strategies and inspiration from the occupation of factories in Argentina. So again, there's another connection. And similarly with the Take Back the Land movement in Florida. Max Rameau is talking right now at another panel. He's one of the leaders, participants in this movement in Florida that have, they occupied liberated a vacant lot in Miami in October 2006. 150 people lived there for 6 months, self-managed. They organized the city with meetings through open meetings and voting and so on. And similarly, he has worked in 2008 to connect homeless people find them foreclosed homes to live in. So this draws, and he's talked about this, and other people who have been interviewed within the Take Back the Land movement have made the connection between the landless movement in Brazil and these actions in Miami and Florida, and the landless movement in Brazil being a group that's operates under the banner Occupy, Resist, Produce. They take over the land so that they're not, waiting for the state, waiting for the political party to legitimize the rights that are inherently theirs naturally. They're using the Constitution, the state, as a tool and they're moving ahead of the law, and the law is catching up with them and saying, okay, well, this is your right, and this is what's happening with the Take Back the Land movement. So there's some examples of, learning, sharing knowledge with this mutual aid across borders. So I'll just end it there.